Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for In the News, our dive into the news stories that have been happening over the last couple of weeks. I'm refreshed from my holiday, and I am joined similarly by two men ready for the new term. Adrian Reynolds, our Head of National Ministries. Good morning, Adrian.
Hello.
And John Stevens, our National Director. Hello, John.
Hi, Phil.
It is the 1st of September. It has that feeling of
pinch and a punch
kicking off all over again, doesn't it? A new term, a month till the next early bird deadline for the Leaders Conference. So if you've not booked yet, do get your tickets. And we welcome a new colleague today as well. Graham Bynan officially starts today as our new head of local ministry. So do pray for him. We're looking forward to gathering with him next week and getting to know him and integrating him into our team. So do remember him in your prayers. John, tell us where you're going after we've recorded this podcast. It's important, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm heading down to Sevenoaks for the Thanksgiving service for Jeremy Marshall. It's important that FIEC is represented there. We have been really grateful for the support of Jeremy, his help to us particularly, his help to the wider evangelical kind of community, his remarkable witness to the gospel in the face of kind of terminal cancer. We talked about that in our last podcast, so you can hear a little bit more. There's a tribute on our website, but we want to give thanks to God for his life. Obviously, we pray for his wife, Jeanette, and family, that they would know the Lord's comfort at this very difficult sort of time.
There's a live stream, which by the time this goes out will be too late to watch, but it will be up on YouTube, the service. Mm. So we'll put the link still in the notes, and people will be able to watch back the service if they want to.
Yeah, many giving thanks for the life of Jeremy, a great servant to the Lord. Adrian, what's your plan for this weekend? You're heading up to
tomorrow,
Northwich.
I'm off to Northwich, Leftwich, who knows, somewhere in Cheshire. Yes, I get confused. What's Leftwich? They just joined together, don't they?
But yes.
Emmanuel Northwich, which is...
In Leftwich.
Yes, thank you. Hopefully the sat-nav knows where I'm going. It's a great FIC church. It was a delight to go and do their church weekend last year. But today it's a building opening. Mm. So they've been working a long time on their building. There's an article on the website we'll put a link in, because it started and it stopped. Their builders went bust. And so when I went for the church weekend, all that was standing were the steels of the building, and it looked like, would it ever get done? But they had some money from the mission fund, for our Centenary Mission Fund, which has been great to support them in that way. And they've had money from other places, and they've raised money, and the building is finished and it's opening today. So tomorrow. So I'm preaching on Psalm 121, Song of Ascents, going up to Jerusalem originally, sung. Amazing. And be talking about, will we make it as Christians? That's the great question that's being answered in Psalm 121. So a great occasion. Really looking forward to that.
And that's a great link into our first story, because there's been a lot in the news about buildings, hasn't there? So schools not opening, perhaps, across parts of England because they've been built with bubbly concrete, I think is what
aerobar concrete. Reinforced, autoclaved, aerated concrete. Is that right? RAAC. Do you have an architectural degree alongside everything else?
No.
I think that's what it's called.
And it's called RAAC.
And between 50s and just about into the 90s, a lot of buildings were built with this material.
Including my primary school. So Eldwick was mentioned in the BBC article yesterday, which is where I went to primary school. So that's one of the buildings that's closing.
It only ever had a 30-year life. Mm. And the challenge is, of course, that especially if you have roofs and beams, walls not so much, but roofs and beams, made of this stuff, they can collapse and the whole building can collapse. It's pretty dangerous, actually.
I kicked many a football against a concrete wall at Eldwick Primary.
572 schools have this in them. 100 are need work. And so children have gone in and been sent home, essentially, or schools have had to make alternative arrangements. And I guess, I mean, I don't know this, but I guess there may be one or two churches that were built 50s to 90s that might have some of the same building material. I don't know.
And that's quite an interesting point, isn't it? Because we do have important health and safety responsibilities, especially if we've got church buildings, John.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got various liabilities that might go if people come into the buildings and they're dangerous. As you say, buildings might fall into disrepair. There are actually all sorts of issues connected with asbestos in buildings these days. There's problems of buildings with wiring that may not have been renewed. And actually, this is often a problem with churches that are smaller, that have perhaps declined, that over time the building may well not have been looked after as well as it might have been. Christians learn to live with inadequacies of the buildings. They bear with it. They don't recognise how off-putting it is perhaps to others coming in. But there is also this serious risks that might be involved with buildings. The responsibilities now in terms of fire regulations, we need to make sure that we observe those. And of course, actually, if somebody were to be severely injured or even sort of killed in a church building, that would be devastating for the cause of the gospel. Mm. There was a sort of a prep school that was fined a very large amount of money this week because of a sort of a collapse of a ceiling. Again, you know, you could imagine the stories if that were in a church situation. So we have to take our responsibilities, if we have buildings, seriously, to make sure that we comply with the law, that we observe all the appropriate health and safety kind of rules. That's for the benefit of everyone.
I think I want to move that on, though, John. I'm not quite with you there, because I don't think we apply these rules because we want to fulfil legal obligations. Yeah. I think fundamentally we do, because we want to love our neighbour.
And it's a biblical mandate as well.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, in Deuteronomy 22, you know, if you build a new house, you have to put a parapet around it, which is not a kind of Prince Charles architectural, you know, make it look nice. It's to protect people who go up on the roofs so they don't fall off.
King Charles.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. So I just think that, you know, there's a lot of bad press given to health and safety. And but actually, at its best, it is a biblical principle. And I think there's a certain segment of society who grumbles at health and safety. And we've just got to fight against that and say, actually, looking out for people, making sure our buildings are not just kind of beautiful, if that's the case, or fit for purpose in terms of what we want to do in them, but actually are safe places. To me, that almost becomes a gospel imperative. So I think you're right. It does fulfill legal obligations, and building regs and all those sorts of things are really helpful, working out what's safe and what's not. But I just think it's a fundamental Christian duty, frankly.
Mm-hmm. And it's not the only building story that's been in the news. Did you pick up about Marks and Spencer's?
Can we do Marks and Spencer's?
You really want to talk about this, don't you?
FIC's favourite retailer. Other retailers are available. I don't know where FIC is positioned on the supermarket spectrum.
But the point is, M&S were told they could bulldoze and rebuild their building.
So this is Oxford Street,
in
Marble Arch. This is their flagship branch.
But then the government said they couldn't.
Well, the local government said they could.
But the national government...
Got planning permission to... So the building is it's an enormous store. It's far too big for them. People don't shop in the same way. They want to have a much smaller store there, and they want to put their offices there on top, and they can't do that with the current building. It's a 1920s, 1930s kind of era building. I think that's right, that sort of age. So it's not quite over 100 years old. But it's a nice building to look at. It's a kind of classic Oxford Street retail building. And so they wanted to knock it down, build again, and it was called in by Michael Gove. So even though it got local planning permission, it was called in by Michael Gove. Two reasons, really. The one that's really being sort of pressed firmly is just the ecological wisdom of tearing down a perfectly good building and building another one. And this has got to stop. It happens a lot in major cities. You've got a perfectly good building. You buy a house, perfectly good house, you tear it down, build a new one. It just looks unsustainable and ecologically mad. So that's kind of the public presentation of it. But also behind that, Michael Gove said, you know, he doesn't like the look of the new building. He wants buildings to look more classical. And there's something about conserving the past. So it's a complex story, because it's not as simple as Gove wants an old building and Marks and Spencer's want a new building. There's a bit more going on there. And I think it does raise some of the complexities that we as Christian leaders feel towards our buildings, those of us who have them. So I'm going to a new building tomorrow. It's great. You preached in the old building. I never saw the old building.
Well, it was a great big long corridor. So it did need, it wasn't fit for purpose.
But they couldn't fit in it.
No, exactly. But I think when I preached there, the congregation was only about 9 deep. But it was a colossally wide kind of building.
I don't think anybody there shed any tears.
No, perhaps not.
Although it's interesting, if you go to some places and buildings have been built by the congregation or funded by the congregation, often there can be an unhealthy nostalgia and connection to a building that actually doesn't allow you as a group of leaders to do anything with your building. Mm. It can be a sort of, I don't want to call it a Govism, because he'll write in. Because he listens to this podcast every Saturday morning.
I'm sure he does.
But so I think we've always feeling this tension with buildings, right, John? That there's kind of a, you know, we're conservatives in our theology. And so we do recognise actually the value of the past. We do recognise what people have done in the past. But also we want to be for the future and for the present, don't we?
I think that's right. And I think it's important to remember, biblically, the church is not the building.
Indeed.
That actually the building is there for a functional purpose, simply to enable God's people to be able to gather. It provides a place for gathering to be able to do the things the church is meant to do. Hear word, pray to God, praise God together, build community together. So a New Testament church had no buildings. Actually, in terms of church architecture, so often churches have been patterned on the pattern of the temple of the Old Testament. People still speak in terms of the church as a holy place. They speak in terms of the sanctuary. Mm. They give it this special significance.
Build it east-west.
And I think that tension between functionality and what it's there for, and this desire to want to create some sort of spiritual ambience, has been a key thing in part of, in church, a kind of architecture. So traditionally, kind of Puritans, nonconformists would have had much more simple buildings because they recognized that its purpose was simply to facilitate the gathering of the people of God. Then in the 19th century, nonconformists started to build grand churches that rivaled Anglican churches because they wanted that social status that went kind of with it. So it's really important for us to think through, what is the building there for? What's its purpose? And we should recognize that everything about our building says something about what we believe and what we practice and what the nature of church sort of is. Do we provide people with comfort? Is it designed to enable people to interact with one another? Is it designed to enable that kind of corporate kind of worship? What does it say about our relationship with the past? Are we traditionalists? Are we seeking to engage with contemporary culture? So you have to look at your buildings from the eye of an outsider coming in. And think to yourself, what do they think this says about us as a community? Because we as Christians, I think, get very used to our building. We're there every week. We stop noticing. We actually need to pay much more attention to what people who don't come regularly think about what our building and the way we do things says about us and who we are and what we believe. And I'd urge pastors to be asking new people, what do you think our building says? Find out what impressions are being created. And they may be positive, or they may be things that need to be kind of overcome. I think the other big challenge is there's a great temptation to think that having a building is success as a church. I've certainly found that with a couple of church plants. COVID has taught us buildings can be great. They're a platform, a place in the community. They can give profile. You can do lots of things through them. There are lots of churches that are now acquiring buildings post-COVID because they've realized the importance of that, but also more buildings becoming available from denominations that are declining and that are selling their buildings. But there is a danger of thinking the building is the thing. Ministry doesn't happen just because you have a building. And I think, therefore, it seems to me a biblical imperative to invest first of all in ministry. And people, a building can be very helpful, but if you, in the end, are not investing in ministry, gospel work, gospel ministry, you won't grow the real kind of church. And I think there's a certain point in a church's life where you could afford a building, but it would be at the cost of investing in ministry. And at that point, you've got to make a really significant choice. The building might look like success, but does it in the end prevent you from actually continuing the gospel work of reaching out and connecting with more people and making disciples? So I think there's a danger of acquiring a building too quickly when it effectively inhibits the very things that will actually grow the body and the people of God.
There's a story on the website just gone on in the last couple of weeks about a church that's bought a building which is too small for them. Have a look at that. It's quite an interesting story.
Yeah, excellent. Well, go well as you go to Emmanuel Northwich in Leftwich tomorrow, Adrian. Let's move on. Let's talk about the Women's World Cup final. And unfortunately, we're not talking about Spain's victory.
No, I predicted a 4-0. I don't know if you heard this. I predicted a 4-0 win for England.
Well, unfortunately, that didn't quite happen. So Spain won 1-0. Congratulations to them. But unfortunately for the Spanish women's team, that's not what the story's been since the World Cup final. So, of course, it centres around Luis Rubiales, who is the Spanish Football Federation president, who kissed the Spanish striker Jenny Hermoso after Spain's victory.
He embraced and kissed many of the players.
Yeah. Yeah,
kissed her on the lips.
But also very publicly grabbed a part of his anatomy that he ought not to have done in celebrating the victory. All in all, it was just...
While standing next to a child.
We can all agree it's not good. It doesn't look good. It shows there's misogyny in football, even in women's football, where there shouldn't be. Some have called it Spain's Me Too movement. There's been no apology. There's been no contrition. In fact, Rubiales has doubled down. That we know it's a bad look. What lessons do we need to draw?
Just worth saying as well, in the broader culture of Spain, I'm not a Spain expert, but even this morning reading that August has been a terrible month, again, as the summer often is, for domestic violence, which is a terrible, terrible thing. 19 women killed by partners in August alone, which is an extraordinary statistic. So I think it's probably it is a very specific story, but it's reflective of a deeper malaise in society in general that we've seen across different countries, and it seems especially in Spain.
Well, my little girl loves football. I want her to embrace football. Happy for her to play football. None of this is good. Is it, John?
I know. I mean, it's revealing of massive changes in social kind of conventions, ways of relating. I think the fact that he appears not to think that he's done anything wrong here and to defend himself is just a complete misreading of how things have changed rightly. That it manifests a kind of a male power, a right to treat somebody into kissing them on the lips, even if it's got a Latin greeting of kissing on the cheeks. That is something beyond that, which is why it is felt to be something sexual, something imposed. There's the whole issue of consent. The player has been saying, "I did not consent to this. Mm. I was essentially forced into this." So it's been a very public revelation of the way men can mistreat women, assume a certain measure of entitlement of what they're able to do, and then defend themselves afterwards.
Yeah, the doubling down is extraordinary, isn't it?
Well, he's quadrupled down. It's just every day.
And it's not just by men. You know, his mother's doubled down. She went on hunger strike, didn't she? Had to go into hospital, Angelis Bejar. She's out of hospital, which is good news. But, you know, the kind of, you know, my son can never do anything wrong. It's an extraordinary rallying round behind him, really. There was a meeting of the Spanish Federation where he defended himself, shouted into the microphone, "I will not resign," 5 or 6 times.
All applauding him.
And the whole audience were applauding him, including the Spanish manager. And it's just extraordinary, really, the doubling down and just the refusal to recognise what just is there, it seems to me, in plain sight.
But I think it's worth recognising that this is a bigger issue of Spanish culture, maybe some Latin cultures of the way that...
Yes, I mean, there's been a story about Italy this week as well. Very similar.
So at one level, we are basically Anglosphere countries in which kind of issues connected to sexual harassment, the way that men and women relate, have changed perhaps more rapidly. There's clearly an issue in some other countries where that is not the case. And this has brought that all to the surface, and it's revealed the kind of the resentment of women and how they're treated and how they're viewed. And of course, the real sadness is it's taken away the focus on football and what the women have achieved in winning the World Cup. This has become the story, rather than actually what should have been the real story of the glorious triumph of the Spanish women's football kind of team. I think in some ways that has a parallel with gospel ministry. There's a sense in which it's all too easy that if pastors, church leaders, if they fall short, if they abuse their position, if they don't treat people appropriately, even if they're misunderstanding the culture rather than deliberately transgressing it, in the end, they will become the story that is a distraction from sort of the gospel. So I think it is a warning to us all to pay careful attention to what are the evolving social conventions, what is the right way to behave, so that we're not misunderstood in the way that we do things. And particularly those from an older generation, they can make assumptions about how people want to relate that are no longer valid. That's why we need to pay attention carefully to culture, carefully to different expectations, and to be cautious. Because actually we don't want to become a distraction from what is the really significant story. And that's exactly what's happened here.
Can I just big up then in that context, Serena Wiegmann, who's the England manager?
Mm. What she did last night, you mean?
Yeah, so she received Coach of the Year award. And I think actually in quite a moving gesture, given what's gone on, dedicated it to the Spanish players. So
because they've been forgotten, basically.
So we see this misogyny happening all the time at the moment, the reaction of some against what they perceive as being an oppressive woke culture, the Andrew Tates of this world. Now, that is very common now amongst a whole younger generation of men, and it's deeply disturbing that it is. It's bound up with pornography, which teaches men to treat women in a particular way. As Christians, we must be concerned about that. To my mind, lots of the gains of feminism about how women are to be treated as equal, not to be sexually harassed, not to be seen as objects, are actually things that are in line with the gospel and the way that we ought to be treating one another. The Bible says that we're to treat women as sisters with complete purity. And the society has changed massively over the last sort of 100 years or so. I've been listening to Jean Twenge's book on generations, the difference in the experience of women in the silent generation, in the boomer generation. The position of women has been radically changed in a good and a right way. I'm similarly reading Dominic Sandbrook's History of Britain from 1956 to kind of the present. And I think as Christians, we need to recognize those changes needed to be made. And they're right and they're good.
It is. We ought to just say, having commented on Latin culture in those ways, that I think although the sort of Northern European countries have made more progress, we haven't made all the progress that needs to be made.
Indeed. Yep. And in fact, I think it was Emma Hayes, the Chelsea manager, was saying the same thing in relation to women's football.
So we must take care. Let's not be proud about it.
Well, let's close this section by saying congratulations to the women's team for winning the World Cup in Spain. Well done to them.
Glad that the England team carried on that dutiful tradition of not quite doing it.
there we are. Maybe next time. Let's move in to talk about a story that was on the front page of the Times earlier this week. So this was a story whereby 5,000 clergy in the Church of England were emailed a questionnaire by the Times newspaper. I think about sort of 1,400 or so responded to that, and the results of which were published on Tuesday this week. Just some headlines from those who responded. It's worth just making that clear. For those who responded, just 24% say Britain is a Christian country. 64% say Britain is a Christian country historically, but not currently. But the bigger, of course, headlines were about sexuality. This polling showed there was a huge number of clergy in favour of abandoning biblical sexual ethics. So embracing same-sex marriage, blessings for same-sex couples, cohabiting, even relaxing sort of what the Bible says about sex before marriage, all these kind of things that the clergy would throw out the window according to this survey. So there's been some questions about methodology, which we might come on to. Thoughts, reactions?
Just as a precursor to all of that, if you want a longer conversation about what's going on in the Anglican Church, there's a previous podcast we did just at the beginning of the summer with Lee Gatiss.
Worth listening to.
And I think that will give a much fairer view of how evangelicals sit within the Church of England. So we don't need to comment on that again, but that's the place to go and look. Mm. And we're, of course, looking in from the outside. So we just want to set it all in that context.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the results are particularly surprising at one level.
Is the Pope a Catholic?
But some Anglicans are saying they are a surprise.
I'm not sure that's the case. There's been an ongoing debate within the Church of England for some time about proposals to want to introduce blessings of gay relationships. There's been a strong pressure group wanting to introduce gay marriage within the church. There have been tolerated large numbers of kind of clergy in gay relationships, civil partnerships, even marriages. So this is not something new. This has been a debate that's been going on within the Anglican Church for a long time. I think the very fact the bishops have been bringing forward proposals to introduce some kind of blessings for same-sex relationships shows that they already recognise there's a majority of people, probably in the pew and amongst the clergy, who want to go in that direction. So this is not...
And indeed, their proposals were voted... by a small margin, were voted through in the Synod.
So I don't think this is a surprise. Overall, that trend has been obvious. And actually, the same is true in a number of other denominations. I mean, if you would look at the URC, if you were to look at the Methodists, it would be even more in favour of sort of abandoning that biblical sexual morality. And those churches have formally adopted that position. So this is part of a kind of a broader picture of many of the historic denominations which long ago have abandoned standing for a kind of biblical truth and biblical sexual ethics. So I think the survey is not surprising. It's obviously come out at this time because it's being used to say this is now an overwhelming majority of people who want to move in this direction. It's part of the political kind of pressure on the church to be able to change its position. And the Times leader, in the light of this survey, was basically the church is behind the Times and it's got to get with the Times and it's got to go with where society is
probably
going.
With a view to the autumn synod, I guess.
I mean, in some ways, it's probably slightly surprising that there are so many people who are opposed to, for example, the church marrying sort of gay couples. So 37% said that they didn't support marrying gay couples. 65% supported gay sex, but that means that something like 35% don't. So actually, in some ways, there is a substantial body, even within the Church of England, of those who do not reject the biblical morality and want to stand by it. And we know that there are large numbers of evangelicals and many of the growing churches in the Church of England that are evangelical will want to stand firmly for that line, and they're fighting the battle for it. But in terms of overall weight of the clergy, they are now in a significant kind of minority. I think the reflection that we're not a Christian country is really significant. I mean, after all, the Anglican Church is the established church, and their established position is a reflection of the fact that we are constitutionally, in that sense, a Christian country. Depends kind of what you mean by that. So we're, as a country, lots of our institutions, lots of our culture have Christian roots, but it's quite clear that kind of today, very few people go to church, attend church in any real sense. The numbers of people who see Christianity as marking significant moments of their life, whether birth, sort of funerals, marriages, confirmations, those are all dropping, and secular and humanist ceremonies are becoming more and more prominent. in those areas. The numbers of people who in any way genuinely believe Christian doctrine and would have a personal faith in the Lord Jesus is sort of very small. Mm. We would estimate 2 to 3% people who would be born again, kind of evangelicals. So I think it's just important to recognize that this is where we are. And I think for the Church of England, because of their established position, it's been very much easier for them for a long time to continue to think we are still a Christian nation. After all, they get to perform all the royal ceremonies, all the national events. They're kind of woven into national life. And that can give you the impression that essentially you are still part of a Christian nation but performing this service. So I think it's fascinating that even those who are now serving in the kind of established church recognize the reality that that is not the situation that we are in. I think the church has tried to convince itself for the past few decades of the idea of people believing but not belonging. They don't come to church, but they're still sort of Christian. I think that is clearly no longer the case or sustainable.
It's worth saying for that surveys like this, not this particular one, but like this, can be very helpful for us as leaders to understand the kind of world we're living in. And I think, surveys generally about lifestyle, about how people live, about what they believe, census results, which are obviously very accurate, just understanding the areas where we are. These kinds of things are really important tools, actually, for us as we reach out into our context. You know, we've got to know, for example, the cultural backgrounds of those around us. Yeah. We don't just want to observe it. We need hard data is really helpful and makes a difference. And I think sometimes when we hear answers we don't like, it's easy to pick apart the methodology. And I can understand that. But in broad terms, Professor Spiegelhalter, who's a professor of Cambridge mathematics, says a lot of these surveys, you can pick apart the methodology, but the broad messages they're giving you are largely right. And actually, those are useful for us to think about how do we engage with an essentially an unbelieving world. Mm.
The Times Leader, you touched on this, John, their response to that would be, well, basically, come on, church, embrace the culture. You're leaving everyone behind. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's extraordinary that you still would oppose, for example, women in leadership was one example given in the Leader. Let's just push back on that because we don't agree with that.
Well, they published a year before an article about the applying the R factor methodology.
Oh, of course, yeah,
to, with the COVID to church thing to churches. Groups, you know, the rate of growth. And the only, it was very striking, the only church groups that were growing were FIEC, Free Church of Scotland, New Frontiers. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think probably if you'd done the analysis and you split the Church of England up, you would have seen the Evangelical Church. That's also true there. So the problem with the Times methodology is it just doesn't work. I mean, there's lots of problems with it theologically, but practically speaking, from their point of view, it's the end of the church. History's told us that, hasn't it? Liberalism doesn't work.
We can't be a Christian country if we're not going to embrace Christian viewpoints. It's ridiculous.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, this has been the deceit or the deception of liberalism really ever the sort of 18th century and the Enlightenment, is that basically the church has got to change to fit with what the world thinks in order to keep people and
everybody
people
will flock
and bring
in.
People in. Mm. That has not been successful. And over time, people, when they discover the church doesn't believe what it's supposed to believe, end up concluding, well, why do I need to bother with it? I might as well just go and do these things in the secular world. I'll give my energies to kind of politics, social work within the wider community. If that's all the church is there for, then why do I need to bother with church in order to do these things? And people then vote with their feet. And the reality is that the churches that aren't faithfully proclaiming Jesus, the gospel, the message of salvation from sin, eternal judgment, the need to live in obedience to Jesus' teaching in all areas of life, including marriage and sexuality, those churches are declining rapidly. They are declining because congregations are aging. They're not seeing young people come in. So I think it's utterly naive to think that if the church changes its position on those things, that suddenly a whole load of people are going to flock back to church, that as if the real reason they're not going to church is because of the church's view on kind of women in leadership or gay marriage or whatever.
Why do you think the Times thinks that? Because I totally agree with you. Why do you think that is a common sort of pitch from secular culture?
Well, I think secular culture doesn't understand the gospel anyway. They don't understand why people are committed Christians. They don't understand what Christianity is.
Essentially, they even feel threatened by it.
Essentially, they bought into the liberal narrative, and that's where they think the whole of culture needs to go. Mm. But the reality is the churches that are growing and that are seeing significant growth are those that are faithfully proclaiming Jesus and are seeing people come to personal faith and conversion in him and desire to be disciples who live for him. And that's the reality we're seeing in our context, two things going on at the same time. The very rapid decline of mainstream denominations and cultural folk Christianity. And this survey basically tells us everything is going to get worse. You know, this tells us where we
are.
Which
is the conclusion you would have come before the survey, isn't it?
Indeed. But, you know, there's nothing here that suggests there's going to be any way forward. In fact, actually, the Anglican clergy have no hope of the kind of decline being restrained. The majority don't think that that can be kind of stopped. Yet at the same time, faithful evangelical churches of all kinds, whether in denominations or outside of them, are seeing kind of growth. The biggest and largest and most sort of significant churches in terms of numbers within the Church of England are all evangelical churches that are preaching the gospel. So that the big picture is that cultural Christianity is in massive decline. Faithful evangelical Christianity is seeing slow, steady kind of growth, and we're living with both of those things at the same time.
We're in our centenary year, Phil, FIEC. Relatively young movement in English history, but 100 years, and God has kept us faithful to the gospel. I think it's just worth always, in this centenary year especially, pausing and giving great thanks to God for that, for keeping, I mean, you know, we haven't kept ourselves faithful, he's kept us faithful to the gospel, and that's great news.
And that is a great place to finish. Time has beaten us, brothers. Thanks so much for joining us. This has been Independence, the FIEC podcast. Do rate, leave a review so others can find it, and we'll look forward to speaking to you again soon. Thanks, John. Thanks, Adrian.
Thank you.
Go well this weekend.
Thank you.